Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Open Forum on Transverse Myelitis, Including Acute Flaccid Myelitis. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Sarah Hopkins and Dr. Cynthia Wang. Sarah Hopkins is a pediatric neurologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's an assistant professor of clinical neurology, Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She sees patients in the pediatric multiple sclerosis clinic at CHOP and has an interest in transverse myelitis. She completed her medical school at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock, Arkansas, her pediatric residency and fellowship in child neurology at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati. Dr. Hopkins also has a graduate degree in epidemiology from the Rowland School of Public Health in Emory University, Atlanta. Dr. Cynthia Wang is an autoimmune neurology fellow at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, supported by the TMA's James T. Lubin Clinician Scientist Fellowship Award. She completed a pediatric neurology residency at the University of Michigan, where she developed interest in rare neuroimmunological disorders in children. Her fellowship training thus far has involved seeing adult and pediatric patients with TM, ADEM, NMO, and ON, with Dr. Benjamin Greenberg and his team. Her primary research interest is in immune-mediated and demyelinating central nervous system conditions in children, particularly ADEM. Her current research project involves studying the long-term neuropsychological and quality of life outcomes in ADEM. So welcome, both of you, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Gigi. Welcome, pleasure to be here too.
Thanks. So just to start, before we jump into the questions, Dr. Wang, I was wondering if you could just give us a brief overview about TM, and then Dr. Hopkins, if you could go then into a little bit more detail about what AFM is and how it differs from just TM.
Sure. So TM, transverse myelitis, is a acquired inflammatory disorder of the spinal cord. We think that maybe an environmental trigger may lead to the event happening. Sometimes an infection. Oftentimes we don't have an exact answer. It is often a monophasic, meaning a one-time event, and that differs from other relapsing disorders such as multiple sclerosis and neuromyelitis optica syndrome. In terms of treatment, I think I'll discuss that later, so maybe I'll stop there and let Dr. Hopkins introduce acute flaccid myelitis.
Sure. So acute flaccid myelitis is a disorder that we've known about and seen a little bit of here and there for quite some time. We think we've had maybe 10 cases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia over the past 10 years. With more, of course, recently in 2014 and 2016. But acute flaccid myelitis is thought to be a direct infection of the spinal cord. A typical case of acute flaccid myelitis is a school age or preschool age child who presents with the acute onset of flaccid or floppy weakness of a limb in the setting of an illness associated with a fever, often with head pain, neck pain, pain in the affected extremity. As with typical TM, or what we think of as idiopathic TM, acute flaccid myelitis is a monophasic process. It tends to be a one-time thing. How it differs from transverse myelitis is that acute flaccid myelitis is typically asymmetric. It's usually more prominent in one extremity than the others, even when there is multi-extremity involvement. And sensory involvement with acute flaccid myelitis tends to be minimal unless you have a significant amount of spinal cord swelling. So I think really those are the those are key differences for me, that we think that AFM is related to an acute infection and that the presentation is asymmetric and that these patients are usually floppy. You know, a patient with transverse myelitis can present with a flaccid paralysis when they first come in, but typically your patients with transverse myelitis are getting tighter and more spastic as time goes on, and that doesn't happen with our acute flaccid myelitis patients. One additional difference is that we see a difference on the imaging in that for acute flaccid myelitis, typically it's just the gray matter or the nerve cell part of the spinal cord that is affected, whereas with transverse myelitis, it's typically either a more complete or patchy involvement of the spinal cord that involves both gray and white matter.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the overview. And so we did get a question from someone, you know, related to kind of the difference between TM and AFM, where her son was diagnosed with TM 5 years ago, but she's thinking he may actually have AFM. So at onset, he had right arm paralysis and lost mobility in his legs, but also had facial and muscle weakness causing his mouth and tongue to droop, and also a loss of speech with drooling. So does this, you know, sound like more like AFM, or can TM cause this to happen to speech as well? Dr. Hopkins?
So I would say that because of the asymmetric onset, just based on the limited information that I have, I would say that it's probably more consistent with acute flaccid myelitis. Certainly, we have seen cranial neuropathies in patients with acute flaccid myelitis. It can happen in some autoimmune disorders and things that cause idiopathic transverse myelitis as well. But certainly, that clinical picture with the acute onset of flaccid paralysis in one extremity, along with cranial neuropathy, is more along the lines of what we see with acute flaccid myelitis. It's important to keep in mind that we weren't really differentiating these 5 years ago either. So, you know, if you'd come to CHOP or basically anywhere with an acute flaccid myelitis type picture 5 years ago, it probably would have been called transverse myelitis.
Right. Okay. And then Dr. Wang, so we got a question about, you know, this is kind of just a general question about, you know, with TM, this person had a damaged spinal cord at T11, T12, and that, you know, this won't heal. You know, as you know, they were saying that a peripheral nerve injury usually heals, but one of the central nervous system doesn't. Is, you know, the only chance of recovery stem cell research? And, you know, has there been any progress with this, or are there other mechanisms for recovery?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely potential for repair and in some ways compensation. The neurons in the spinal cord, unfortunately, once injured, there's limited repair, but there's new studies of different remyelinating agents that might, you know, maybe not reconnect wires, but make the transmission of partially injured wires more efficient. Stem cell therapy is coming, and I think becoming increasingly more of a reality. I think Dr. Greenberg here is actually working on a very initial pilot study with idiopathic transverse myelitis patients, probably in the next calendar year. So those are definitely out there, but I think for the majority of people, recovery really comes from rehabilitation during the acute period. Inpatient rehabilitation is very helpful in terms of assisting with people in walking, trying to, you know, correct maybe poor mechanics that may result from damage to the spinal cord causing, you know, weakness. But really over time, just sustained therapy through physical therapy, sometimes occupational therapy if it's more, adjusting to daily life and activities of daily living, those are sort of the mainstays of recovery. In some of these therapies, there's ways to use functional electrical stimulation to help sort of reinforce the connections that are made. So we're a big advocate of things in which electrical stimulation, in addition to certain movements, can sort of create and strengthen connections.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then, you know, really, so does AFM or TM, you know, occur in only certain age groups? So I know we've heard a lot of about AFM in children, but can it also occur in adults? And, you know, with TM as well, is there a trend of it happening more in adults or children?
Go ahead and start, Dr. Hawkins.
No, that's okay. For sure, either of them can happen at anyone at any age. With TM, we think about two different peaks. You know, one, there can be a peak during childhood, and then also another peak when you're a little bit older, like in your 30s. AFM does typically occur in childhood. You know, whether that has something to do with the immune system development or why that happens is not entirely clear. That said, there have been some reported cases of AFM in older people. They tend to be primarily in people that have some kind of history of immunocompromise or some medicine that might make them more susceptible. But there certainly have been cases reported in older people, just mostly in kids.
Thank you. We got a lot of questions about different symptom management strategies. So one question we got was that someone was diagnosed with transverse myelitis in 2001, and you know, they try to get as much exercise as possible, but they do have really severe spasms. So they're wondering why muscle spasms occur. And then, you know, if there's anything that can be done for the muscle spasms, whether that's medically or other interventions as well.
I can start with that one. So that sounds like what we call idiopathic TM. We don't see spasticity or tightness as much with acute flaccid myelitis. Like Dr. Hopkins said, it's more of a floppy tone. But with direct injury to parts of the spinal cord, where a lot of kind of the wires run, that can lead to that interruption of that transmission of signal can lead to the muscles becoming tighter. There are different modes of therapy. I think medication is probably where most physicians start, and that can range from medications such as baclofen or other relaxants, Flexeril, antispasmodic medications. I think stretching, like the individual had mentioned, is definitely one of the mainstays of non-pharmacologic management. So I understand it's very frustrating if that person's not getting the results, but definitely keeping a stretching regimen, I think, is very vital to maintaining looseness of the muscles. And then in terms of potentially more invasive procedures, there are ways to kind of pharmacologically stop the muscles from contracting, and that is therapies such as injectable botulinum toxin. And probably the most invasive way is intrathecal baclofen, in which the baclofen medication is directly infused into the spinal fluid. There are definitely benefits and risks of doing this. The benefit is that it's not kind of exposed to the whole person. These are all very sedating medication. The risk, of course, is having an external device implanted, and that can, you know, lead to potential dysfunction of the device over time. So that's one of the, I guess, the key worries with that kind of a device. Stop there for a moment.
Thank you.
I think that if I remember correctly, one part of that question was also why does it happen? And the way that I usually discuss it, talk about it with my patients, is that your brain tends to have kind of a calming effect and helps to mediate the muscle tone in the rest of your body. And sometimes if you have transverse myelitis or something that affects your brain and it interferes with that calming input from the brain, then sometimes that's when you get the spasticity and when you can get the muscle spasms that are uncontrolled.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's very helpful. Also talking about potential symptoms, in AFM, how often do people end up on a ventilator? Is this an issue that occurs in as well with TM? Dr. Hopkins, if you want to take lead on the AFM part.
Well, so it's some people do end up requiring respiratory support with AFM, and I'm actually trying to remember the number from the reported CDC cases in 2014. What I can tell you is that of our 16 reported cases of AFM that we've seen here at CHOP, we've had a total of 3 patients requiring intubation and 2 of those requiring tracheostomy. So in all, it's a relatively small subset of our patients, probably 20% or less for sure. I'm going to look up that number while I've got it in my head, and then I can let you know the actual number from the CDC report in 2014.
Thank you. And Dr. Wayne, if you could just talk about, when this occurs in TM, how often people end up, needing a ventilator and how this happens.
Yeah, definitely. I would think from my experience that less than 20% number is accurate. It depends where in the spinal cord that the injury occurs. So in terms of controlling the diaphragm and the respiratory muscles, it usually is in kind of the middle of the cervical spine. So if people had lower injuries, then most likely they would only have leg involvement, not arm or respiratory involvement. So it sort of just depends where the transverse myelitis or acute flaccid myelitis strikes. I think in my experience, I've probably seen more of the AFM population need ventilatory support. And this is also kind of anecdotal, but I think in the younger patients, they tend to, either have more severe presentations of AFM or just more longitudinal lesions. And I think thinking back to the patients I've seen, there's probably been 3 or 4, and I would say 3 of them were children less than 2 years. So that's probably been my experience. At least the older child was able to eventually just have a tracheostomy without needing a ventilator. I think the younger children still are needing some ventilatory support, but over time we see they strengthen in their respiratory muscles just like they do in the muscles of their extremities. I think the longer we follow out this population, especially of the AFM patients, I think we're seeing that they can be weaned to lower ventilator settings and hopefully can be decannulated from the tracheostomy.
Okay, thank you both. And we've gotten 2 questions that are related to diagnosis. So people are asking about the difference between a spinal cord stroke or infarction and TM, and what's the difference in lesions that may appear and how is the diagnosis differentiated between these two? Dr. Hopkins, if you could start.
So I think sometimes that's one of the hardest things. So sometimes you see a patient and even just before you even do an MRI, you have a really good idea by their examination and how symmetric their examination is, whether they're spastic or floppy, and what other symptoms they had in a presentation. You may have a good idea whether you think they have AFM or TM. Sometimes it's much less clear. Sometimes you can have a patient with acute flaccid myelitis who has some spinal cord swelling at the time they present that can cause secondary changes related to the long tracts of the spinal cord that can give you some sensory findings, or even some spasticity in other extremities that might look more like transverse myelitis. I think one of the hardest ones, and one that we struggle with sometimes, is whether the presentation may be acute flaccid myelitis or maybe a spinal cord stroke. The imaging can look similar because particularly with anterior spinal artery strokes, the abnormality can sit right in the anterior horns, which is the same place that's affected when you have acute flaccid myelitis. Sometimes some additional imaging studies like DWI studies, which can be bright in an acute spinal cord stroke, can be helpful. Sometimes imaging of the blood vessels with something like an angiogram, if we have a really high clinical suspicion that it could be vascular, those things can help. Sometimes as well, just thinking about the timing of the presentation can be helpful. You know, generally we think of transverse myelitis presenting with the maximal time to weakness between 4 hours and 21 days, and a spinal cord stroke being shorter than that. That said, I do know of some patients that I truly believe have acute flaccid myelitis who presented more quickly. So the answer is there are some ways to start to differentiate between them, but occasionally you have a patient that's more difficult, and sometimes it can be hard to classify.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Wang, are there if a patient is presenting with either a spinal cord stroke or TM or AFM, are there different treatment options between the two, or are they the same? Can you just expand on that a little bit, please?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely agree that the history and the timing, and if there's any circumstantial situations in which, you know, that would predispose somebody to a stroke, such as, you know, trauma, sometimes after a surgery. So I think those things are very valuable. In terms of acute treatments, with transverse myelitis, and some would say acute flaccid myelitis, immunomodulatory therapies can be helpful, since the basis for the pathology is kind of an overactive or misdirected immune response. So in those cases, it would be oftentimes intravenous high-dose methylprednisolone, which is a type of steroid. The other two modes of treatment we use most often is something called intravenous immunoglobulin. They're just sort of pooled antibodies, a blood product from many donors. And then something called plasma exchange, which is, akin to a dialysis, but it's trying to remove any pathogenic or disease-causing antibodies in the blood. None of these therapies, I think, in theory, would potentially worsen a stroke. When we think about stroke in sort of the typical sense of a stroke of the brain, there are sort of clot busting or thrombolytic medications that can be used. But I think for spinal cord stroke, as a resident and a fellow, I don't see that used very much. So I think when it comes down to if there's a question of which one it is, I think there's more potential benefit of trying some of the immunotherapies rather than, you know, in some cases not being able to do much at all for ischemic or ischemic stroke.
Okay, thank you. And, I apologize. I'm trying to get through as many questions as possible. They may jump from topic to topic a little bit. So we got actually two questions about this. So one of the questions states that the person got transverse myelitis last December, and that they've noticed, you know, they have paralysis from their chest to their toes, but that their voice has decreased in its ability to speak or sing. Is this an effect of TM? And someone else said that their voice also becomes very soft and is little more than a whisper and stays that way for many days. Dr. Hopkins, do you mind addressing that question?
So I think this is one of the questions, one question that could be a little hard to answer without actually being involved in the care of the patient, but I can think of a couple different reasons that this might be happening. The first one is that particularly if you've had high If you've had cervical spine involvement with your transverse myelitis, if you have some weakness of your respiratory muscles or and some weakness of your diaphragm, sometimes being a little hoarse and having a very soft voice can be related to not being able to generate enough breath to kind of sustain the voice. If the incident happened recently and you've recently been intubated or had a tube to help you breathe, then sometimes there can be injury to the vocal cords with that, and sometimes that can cause you to be hoarse for a little bit. And also sometimes there can be kind of a vocal cord paralysis. So that may be something that it's worth seeking care from an ENT physician for, to kind of take a look and see if there's anything there, any problems with the movement of your vocal cords that may be causing an issue.
Great, thank you. And we've gotten several questions about pain as well. You know, what are the long-term kind of effects of TM and potentially AFM is that people experience pain. And so, Dr. Wang, can you speak a little bit about, you know, what is used to manage pain that's associated with transverse myelitis, and, you know, if there's anything promising, you know, that any developments that might help in the future with this?
Certainly. Pain is unfortunately one of the most difficult and perhaps lingering symptoms of transverse myelitis, and certainly one of the symptoms that impacts quality of life the most. There's a lot of potential reasons that could be, causing and perhaps propagating or perpetuating the pain. The damage to the spinal cord kind of takes away a signal that the nerves are getting from the brain and the spinal cord that may sort of dampen down pain or at least interpret the signal. So it's sort of like the nerves are not quite communicating correctly. So sensations can be misunderstood, and that can be interpreted by the body as pain. Again, it's medications that we usually start with just because we can start them, see if they're effective. If not, increase the dose or kind of play around with that therapy. The ones that we use are sort of the neuropathic type pain medications, and that includes things such as gabapentin or Neurontin, pregabalin or Lyrica, and duloxetine or Cymbalta. Those are some of the ones I think of first. Other types of, and we borrow a lot from other classes of medications. So some of these can be viewed as, seizure drugs. So another couple of seizure drugs include carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine. Those are two different drugs. Tegretol is carbamazepine and oxcarbazepine is trileptal. Unfortunately, there's not exact, science or method to deciding which one. We kind of try to think about the individual and if they have any medical comorbidities that may help one make more sense than the other. But mostly it's a trial and error process in terms of starting at a low dose so we avoid side effects and then slowly going up. In terms of other ways to kind of lessen the pain, I think individuals who don't get much response or they have intolerable side effects, they look to sort of alternative and complementary techniques. And I know certainly of many patients who've had benefit with things like acupuncture. So I think it's worthwhile to explore, and if someone is medication averse, it may be worthwhile to talk to their physician about providers who may be offering other things besides medications.
Great, thank you. And part of that question was whether there's anything on the horizon to potentially repair nerve damage. And I know you did mention that Dr. Greenberg is working on this pilot study, so that's great as well. And we've gotten a lot of questions actually about AFM and the CDC, where some parents of children have kids with, you know, that have been diagnosed with AFM, but the CDC does not confirm the case or doesn't count the case for various reasons. Dr. Hopkins, do you have any experience with this or knowledge about it?
Well, so I think it's something that it's hard to comment about except for on a case-by-case basis. I think, again, and I think that sometimes having been involved in review of some cases for CDC myself, I can speak to the fact that sometimes the data that's provided is not always entirely complete, and sometimes sometimes it's just very difficult to know for sure based on the information that we get. Sometimes there's a case report that comes in and it's very clearly AFM. Sometimes there's a case report that comes in and it's very clearly not AFM. And sometimes you don't really have enough information to make a definitive decision. So I think that if there's a case where a physician feels strongly that a patient has AFM and that there's some use to having a dialogue about it, you know, I would encourage that they try to reach out and address that. But I can't really speak to specific cases.
Right, of course. Thank you. And Dr. Wang, I think earlier you mentioned FES or E-stim, electrical stimulation, being used as part of a rehab or therapy program. We did get a question asking if E-stim is effective in AFM when there's no muscle response, or also, I mean, I would say in TM if there's no muscle response.
I think it depends. So oftentimes the connection, especially with AFM, can be fairly severely damaged, that there's not an obvious muscle contraction. Sometimes where we can help decipher that is with a study called an EMG nerve conduction study, just to see if there is sort of a pathway, a connection still between the spinal cord and the muscle, and that can inform us if a person may respond to the treatment. In terms of the question of whether it's helpful, I feel like it's almost more helpful I guess it's one of the things that can be helpful in AFM, since so far we've seen, you know, the recovery be a bit slower than idiopathic TM, that just getting stimulation, it helps those muscles get kind of some feedback so that they do not atrophy. So actually we really recommend electrical stimulation for AFM, just to sort of prevent the muscles from becoming smaller. So, you know, we always talk about downstream. In the future, we'll have hopefully these repair techniques to make the connection again. We just want to emphasize that, you know, if the muscles are weak, the joints are locked because, you know, there's not movement to those muscles, then that makes a person harder. It makes it harder for an individual to be a good person to receive those oncoming therapies.
Right. So rehab is both, you know, getting stronger, you know, for current function, but also potentially preparing for, if there's restorative therapies in the future, having, you know, the muscle strength to be able to actually do those. So that's very helpful. I think Dr. Hopkins, you mentioned when talking about the difference between a spinal cord stroke and TM that the onset time is a little bit different typically. So we did have one question about the timing of TM, about the timing of the onset. So this person had an onset that they said was over a course of 6 months. And they're currently in the gray area of, you know, between if it's just TM or if it's actually MS. But does this ever happen where the onset is that gradual over time?
I have never had a patient with onset that was that gradual over time. And for me, of course, I'm a pediatric neurologist, not an adult neurologist, but for me, that would suggest that maybe we need to be 100% sure that we've thought about other diagnoses other than just idiopathic TM.
Yeah, I would agree. I think if it's a, you know, it's the symptoms that the same symptoms steadily increasing over that period, it would be very unusual with these sort of inflammatory diseases that typically occur over days to sometimes weeks. If it's more that some has a like a relapsing course, like there's more than one episode that's occurring over that period and that's leading to worsening injury, then I guess that could be concerning for things like multiple sclerosis and neuromyelitis optica, but a very gradual, insidious disease may kind of trigger thought about, you know, different muscle disorders or other inherited or genetic disorders of nerves.
Great, thank you. And Dr. Wayne, we did get some questions about people's symptoms kind of getting worse over time. How often does this happen where someone has, you know, is diagnosed with TM and then several years later does experience a decline? And you know, how do you differentiate? How do you make sure that this decline is just happening versus a recurrent attack?
Yeah, I think with good history, you know, if the decline seems to be fairly sudden over over hours to days to weeks, then that person should be talking to their physician about whether studies to investigate the potential of a relapse should be done. We often see exacerbations of sort of old symptoms or the original symptoms of a TM or AFM when the body's under physiological stress. So anything that kind of takes it out of its comfort zone, such as heat, illness, sometimes even, you know, not eating enough, dehydration, and inadequate sleep, anything that kind of disrupts the body's normal way of kind of coping with things can make symptoms come on. The thing about these, what we sometimes call pseudo exacerbations, is that it should be transient, it should be temporary. Once the body kind of returns to its normal state of being, the symptoms should get better. And that's one way of differentiating between a relapse and sort of just a transient return of symptoms. And then I think it also gets in the question is perhaps for individuals who are older, and especially with AFM, we compare AFM sometimes to polio syndrome. And we know in the polio population, as people get older, they can have a post-polio syndrome in which, you know, symptoms of weakness may be more apparent as they get older. And it kind of gets to the, I guess, the notion that, you know, your body and your nerves, there is sort of atrophy and wearing away over time. So as somebody gets older, they have just less reserve to really compensate. And that could explain a progression or perceived progression of symptoms. So I think it's definitely good to be on the lookout for potential relapses. But it is sort of an individual, again, case by case basis that the person should address with his or her physician.
Right, of course, that makes sense. And then, sorry, we did get another question too about. I think this is more directed toward for AFM. You know, has there been any success with nerve transfer surgery in patients with AFM, Dr. Hopkins?
Yeah, so there has been some reported information about nerve transfer as particularly for patients with significant upper extremity weakness. I don't personally have as much experience with that. We were very lucky with our patients in 2014. Our patients who had upper extremity weakness actually have tended to overall do quite well over the past 2 years. But I know in some other centers there has still been significant weakness, and some centers have used nerve transfer. We have used it in one of our more recent patients. That surgery was just recently done. So basically, what you do with a nerve transfer surgery is you take a nerve that kind of the body can spare, often going to one of the ribs, and you use that to reinnervate some parts of usually a weak arm. Legs are tougher, is my understanding, simply because you've got a longer way to go and there aren't as many potential donor nerves in the lower extremity. But we have seen some people using it for arm weakness.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Gigi?
Yep.
I wanted to provide an update on that number of patients intubated.
Yes.
And it looks like for the CDC, the 120 reported cases in 2014, we were actually really close. The percent of patients intubated was 20%. So that was close. And if I could, I wanted to say one more thing about the CDC data collection.
Of course, yeah, go ahead.
So I think it's also important to remember that a clinical diagnosis is not the same thing as a case definition that you would use for epidemiology reasons. So for a case definition, you want to be sure that all the cases that you're counting have as close to the same disorder as possible. So that may be one reason why there would be a difference between a diagnosis that one specific neurologist was giving and whether or not it was included as a CDC case or maybe instead a probable case or something like that, simply because it is a different purpose. It's not necessarily for a diagnosis of a patient. It's a case definition for epidemiologic purposes. But they are also in the process of changing the reporting form. The reporting form was onerous and often would be incomplete. So that's going to be more limited, but with more information provided to help hopefully be sure that all the patients are classified correctly. So things like neurology consult notes and images for all the patients will be requested by CDC going forward. So that should help with some of that disconnect as well.
Right. And as you said earlier, too, that this is, you know, we've only recently been classifying AFN as different than TM. And so all of this stuff sometimes just takes time to figure out through trial and error and stuff.
Right. I mean, sometimes, you know, you might have a note. It doesn't document, you know, sometimes we'll get patients and there's not weakness documented. And if you don't have weakness that we see that's clearly documented, then, you know, you can't say that you have AFN. So, anyway, it's challenging on all fronts, I think.
Right, right.
I think something we didn't maybe explicitly mention is that there's increasing thought that the acute plasmomyelitis is related to viral infection, specifically enterovirus infection, enterovirus D68. And I think, you know, it depends sort of, I'm not sure for the cases that you mentioned, Gigi, like who told them that wasn't likely the case. But sometimes what providers test is that Zach virus to do a respiratory test to see if we can recover any of that virus and any of the secretions in the nose. And our test for that is it's not optimal. It's not complete. It does not, I guess you could say there's some false negatives that somebody may have had the virus, but it was shed or the test maybe had been done too late. So I think a lot of the confusion may be that, you know, if they tested negative for that, people think, oh, this is not AFM, where it could just have been that it was a false negative or there was a delay for that testing to be done. So we never made the link that it may have been related to the intravirus.
Right. Thank you. And, you know, just related to thinking about what the potential diagnosis could be. So we did have questions from some folks who have recurrent TM, which I know is, I mean, at least in my experience of being with the TMA, I do hear of this happening sometimes, but people who are negative for the NMO antibody. Dr. Wang, how often do you see recurrent TM happen, you know, outside of the context of something like NMO? And, you know, what is used to kind of differentiate that from NMO?
I'm really glad you brought up that question. So, The classical syndrome of recurrent transverse myelitis is neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, NMOSD. And much of that literature involves people who are positive to antibody NMO-IgG or aquaporin-4 antibody. It's a water channel on certain types of cells in the nervous system. In terms of kind of that subset, we know that those patients go on to almost inevitably have relapses in either the spine or the optic nerve if they're untreated. I think another population that we're starting to learn more about is the people, and especially in a pediatric population that have antibody to myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, MOG or MOG. I think in the last couple of years, there's been increasing interest and research that in a pediatric cohort where children can have kind of the same longitudinally extensive or multiple levels of spinal cord involvement of TM. They can also have optic neuritis, often bilateral optic neuritis, and sometimes brain lesions as well. And we're sort of lumping them into an NMOSD, but because oftentimes these children test negative for the aquaporin antibody, we don't have an exact answer, but in this subset, we've sent testing for MOG, and a good number of them are coming back positive. So I would say this is sort of another type of syndrome that can be relapsing in addition to the classical NMO and multiple sclerosis. For idiopathic TM to come back again, I think would be exceedingly unlikely, almost sort of like, lightning striking twice, because again, from prior podcasts, you've talked about how, it's a sort of a one-time event because an individual in the setting with a certain trigger kind of leads to that to happen. And that's so rare, by just statistics, shouldn't happen twice in one person's lifetime.
Right. Thank you. We also got some questions about in terms of the long-term effects. Bladder and bowel dysfunction is pretty, it was a common question. So have you seen patients that have improved, from the initial onset with bladder and bowel dysfunction, and how are these issues managed clinically? Whoever wants to take this one.
So in pediatrics, there is some data that bowel and bladder function can continue to improve over time, even over as long as 3 years. Certainly it depends on precisely what's going on, whether the recommendation is for intermittent casts or, how that is managed. But I think, having a good urologist involved and a urologist who's experienced with neurologic neurologic conditions is really, really essential. But there have been some case series in pediatrics where we have seen improvement over time.
Yeah, I would agree. It seems like it's one of the more maybe long-standing or long-lasting symptoms. I've seen patients where they've had near paralysis at onset and they gain a lot of their strength back, but one of the residual symptoms is occasional incontinence or having some difficulty urinating. So we luckily have a neurourologist at UT Southwestern, and they can perform different types of studies to assess, is it because the bladder is too floppy or too stiff, and there's certain types of medications that can help depending on sort of the way the bladder is functioning.
Okay, thank you. Then we did get a question about someone is experiencing banding pain in their torso, as we know, banding pain is pretty common and is a type of neuropathic pain potentially. Would there be any issue to, for example, fly on an airplane with this type of pain? Having different pressure be, affect it? And are there any other issues that someone should think about before they're, traveling via airplane? Dr. Wang?
I don't know. I guess if that person individually has had issues with like barometric pressure changes causing worsening of symptoms, and that might be a potential thing to avoid in that individual. I personally haven't heard of that as much. I think a lot of things come with travel, such as maybe not enough sleep, not hydrating, not eating regular. So I would try to sort out if it could be related to something else that may be, kind of perturbing the body's normal kind of homeostasis.
Right, that makes sense. And then, Dr. Hopkins, I know that you, as you mentioned, you've worked a little bit doing with the CDC. So one question was that this person knows of two children with AFM in nearby neighborhoods to one another. Do you know if AFM is being seen more commonly in groups or if it's more widespread?
So my involvement has really been more kind of in the case review capacity, and I have not seen the data sets that or a data set or a map that kind of lays out the locations of the cases. So certainly, there have been some clusters of cases that have been reported, like the Colorado in 2014 and some other places, but I don't, and we certainly had more cases here in Philadelphia in 2016, but in terms of specific numbers and locations, it's not information that I have.
Right, and there might be more information on the CDC website too about in terms of locations. I'm not sure, but it's worth looking for.
I think right now it says country aggregate data. I believe that they rely on the individual health departments to decide kind of when to report the cases.
Okay. And then we did get a question about. Someone has started to experience lymphedema in one leg. Is this a common occurrence in TM, Dr. Wang, or is swelling an issue that happens?
Lymphedema or swelling, I guess, can happen if there's in any area of the body where there's limited movement. Partially moving extremities can help with some of the swelling in the legs. So if somebody is paralyzed in one or both legs, then there can be kind of some gravity dependent swelling, just if they're, not walking and not using the legs. I'm not really sure there's, if it is related to lack of movement, there's certainly things that can be done, such as using compression stockings, elevating the leg. If there's a way to be more mobile, if that individual, has the capacity to do more exercise that involves moving their legs, that would be helpful. I think it's to me, it seems like it's more of a problem that exists when, with anybody who's had paralysis and just cannot move those body parts that normally movement would help with reducing kind of fluid to go to one place.
Okay, thank you. So we're almost out of time. I just have two more very quick questions. So one of the questions was talking about, that they need to have a hip replacement. Are there any increased risks that they should be aware of? They have TM and are partially paraplegic and walk. And, I would just expand this broader to just if someone's having surgery, are there any kind of increased risks that someone should think about if they have TM or AFM?
I don't think necessarily. I think with surgeries, as a shock to the body, anything that the body has to adapt with new, it can cause certain setbacks and, ability for them to return to their prior status of mobility. And then I think with any surgeries, we get concerned about, being somewhat immobile during the surgery, in the days after the surgery, and then one potential complication of that is developing deep vein thromboses or clots. So I think especially if that person may not have much movement in the legs to begin with or not as much movement as they used to, I think that would be something that they should discuss with their doctor about, ways of preventing any secondary injury from the surgery, such as clots in the legs or clots that travel to the lungs. That could be quite serious.
Okay. And then just as our last question, somebody asked, you know, that their daughter is a T8-T10 spinal cord injury from AFM and has, you know, autonomic dysreflexia, bowel and bladder issues. And are there, do you know if there's any current studies happening that are available to people with TM or AFM?
Specifically with the bladder and autonomic dysreflexia?
I would say just in general, any studies that are currently enrolling or available.
So I don't know, Dr. Wang, if you're aware of any treatment studies. I am not. I'm aware of a couple of different study opportunities about kind of the natural history of TM and AFM, but nothing treatment wise.
Yeah, and I would say I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I think the transverse myelitis community should, you know, maybe sometimes also think a little outside of our small community. I've heard people equate it as, you know, a spinal cord injury. So if there are studies that recruit people who've had some sort of spinal cord insult and looking at bladder and bowel, you know, they could look into see if they might meet the inclusion criteria for those types of studies. But I don't know of any specifically, just because the nature of studies is you need a good population to be able to make, to come up with, I guess, answers. So unfortunately, we have a pretty small population of people. So the focus from the scientific community may not be there quite yet.
And I think in terms of observational studies, there is the CAPTURE study, which is this, you know, prospective study of pediatric transverse myelitis. That's and the PI is Dr. Greenberg there in UT Southwestern. And there are several sites across the country, and you can enroll and kind of be followed over time and CPT and OT with those visits. And also that data contributes to our understanding of TM and AFM, and also, you know, what treatments may be affected and things like that. And the other thing moving forward with AFM, there are several children's hospitals, well, and other institutions that are working to kind of figure out, based on how we've treated people in the past, what are the optimal treatments for AFM moving forward. So I think those are two important things that are kind of ongoing, although not directly a treatment trial.
Great. Well, thank you both very much. I think this has been very helpful. A lot of questions were answered, so that's great. So thank you both very much for joining us. And as just a reminder to everyone listening, this will be made available and put on our website in our resource library, and you can also download it via iTunes. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.